As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This is a podcast from The Times, sports newspaper of the year.
Hello and welcome to The Game with me, Gabriel Marcotti. It's a mostly international themed show this week. We'll look at England's successes and challenges, and Rio, of course. We'll also look forward to the challenge they can expect from Montenegro, a bit of Wales, a bit of Scotland, a bit of Croatia and Serbia. We're also going to be taking a look at performance-enhancing drugs in football. Are they there? This is all in light, of course, of the Operación Puerto trial and the lovable Eufemiano Fuentes, name that will no doubt be familiar to cycling fans the world over. Oh, and who is this we that I refer to? It's former Arsenal and Coventry player. That was back when Coventry had a stadium and not one that was owned by some weirdo hedge fund in the Cayman Islands, Stuart Robson. Rory K. Smith in the studio. And, of course, Matt Hughes in Montenegro. Let's start with England. Hughesy, did you learn anything about from the San Marino game?
We learned that England prepared well, prepared professionally. We learned that Ashley Young and Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain can strike a ball pretty well when it falls to them outside the box. But in terms of, we also learned Roy Hodgson's a bit of a liar. Lawyer's alert, because he said on Thursday night, "I've not thought about Montenegro at all," then proceeded to put out a team in training that will look very similar to the team that will play tomorrow, and picked a completely different team on Friday night against San Marino. So obviously he was trying to show San Marino a bit of respect. But in terms of how ready England are for tomorrow night's challenge, I don't think we learned anything at all, really.
Now, let's refer to the Montenegro game as taking place on Tuesday night, not tomorrow night, of course, because podcasts are timeless. Isn't that right, Skinner?
Yeah.
There you go. Thank you, Skinner. I guess nobody wants to debate whether Roy Hodgson really is a liar. Does anybody have any interesting to say about the San Marino game?
No,
apart from I did the Spain game versus Finland, and Finland put 10 players in their own penalty box and Spain couldn't break them down because they didn't play enough balls in the box. What England did against San Marino, a poor San Marino side, they got the balance right between passing the ball and keeping possession and penetrating at the right time. And if a team does want to defend deep, if you get crosses into the box enough times, eventually the ball will drop to the right players and you'll score goals. So I think England got it exactly right. Kept possession well, but also played with penetrative passes and penetrative play in the right areas.
If you get the ball into the box enough times, Rory, Charles Reap would be proud.
I know, Stuart Robson there vindicating the 1950s theory of football. I think to be fair to England and Roy Hodgson, which is not something that I'm comfortable doing, they're unwinnable games in a sense, though, aren't they, against the really tiny nations? Because even if you win 8-0, everyone just says, "Oh, well, you should be beating them 8-0." If you don't win 8-0, if you're unconvincing, like they were against Andorra in 2007, the criticism is intense. So I think all you can say really is England did their job, well done. Move on to the next one.
What England seem to be doing quite well at the moment, I've seen them in years gone by where they've played, and I've heard pundits say, "All you need to do is just pass the ball against these teams, but just pass it simply, keep the ball." Well, you don't break teams down by keeping the ball. You don't break teams down by passing the ball on something. You have to have players that go past people with the ball. And that's at the moment, England had a bit of that, and they also passed it well. So the balance was absolutely right to play against San Marino.
Let's move on to the real thing. Hughesy, just for those who've been under a rock or those who don't really care about England, can you just sum up this whole Rio Ferdinand diatribe?
The diatribe.
Well, just all this thing. Like,
what do you mean?
He's there, he's not there, he calls him, he pretends he says he's injured, he needs to follow his training regimen. His training regimen apparently involves him going to Doha so he can take a lot of money from the Qatari royal family and you know, be the clown in the cage. I like Rio, but I really don't get this. I really don't understand how people, because this is the thing, right? And I've done a bit of work for Al Jazeera myself a few years ago. But I really don't understand this thing. You're a professional. You make an enormous amount of money. These people snap their fingers and boom, you pick up, you go to you go to Doha. And you appear, to an audience of, 10,000? An audience is maybe like the population of San Marino, since nobody watches it outside of expats in the Middle East. Or not even the Middle East. Expats in the Gulf who get Al Jazeera. I don't understand what would motivate somebody to do that unless he's basically retired from the national team. I don't get it.
It is hard for us mere mortals to understand and get an insight into the psychology of a footballer. But I think it's sort of just...
How much money could they have offered him?
Well, it's not just about money.
So what is it?
It's about money. It's about ego. It's about, I guess, it's perceived to be being valued in what's seen as an important market increasingly.
And I think...
What important market? The Emirates? There's like five people. The Qatar is a country of 600,000 people. Well, they either know who Rio Ferdinand is or they don't.
But is Rio Ferdinand going to go into management or is he going to go into television? He's going to go into television from what I can understand, and that's where he's starting it, doing it now, so that he's making his name.
On Al Jazeera, where nobody sees him.
This is a real shame, though, because I want Rio to go into television, but I don't want him to go into punditry. Why can't he remake Rio Ferdinand's World Cup Mercs or whatever it was called? That's Rio's real talent.
That was pretty funny. So, no, but I'm serious. Can you shed some light on this? Because now... it's his time off and he can keep his training regimen despite fighting a cut or whatever. But if I owned a football club and I had contracts, or when I own a football club, I will stop people from doing this kind of crap.
We're going to get onto him in a minute. Gordon Strachan is manager of Scotland. He is still a pundit for ITV, I think. I can't see how that works. When I was at Wimbledon, one good thing that Sam Haman did, and he did several good things, I would say, did some bad things, but one thing he always said is, my manager will not appear on TV. Joe Kinnear was his manager at the time, and he wasn't allowed to do any punditry. He wasn't allowed to comment on any games. All he could comment on was the Wimbledon games. That was one of the... He said, if I'm paying him a three-year contract and I'm paying him all this money, I expect him to go and watch the opposition, not go on a TV channel and start being a pundit.
And Joe Kinnear obviously was a great loss to punditry.
But, Hughie, realistically...
any manager, I would say. With,
well, just going forward, what's the outcome here? I mean, is Rio's England career over? Are we back to that thing where he only gets called up if he's going to start, or what?
Personally, I think his England career is over, but I don't think that's because of his trip to Doha. I think it's because of the fact that it's difficult to envisage any situation in which he can play. If Man United and he are saying he can't play twice in a week, then he's of no real value to the England team. You can't take a centre-back to a World Cup for a one-off game. We tried that with Ledley King in South Africa, and it backfired spectacularly. If there's a real... Just looking ahead, is he going to want to go to... Is he and Ferguson going to want to let him go to Brazil at the end of the season for a friendly? No. I guess maybe he could be brought back for the qualifiers at home next autumn. But I think this was his real chance to get back into the team, and he's rejected it. I think it's a shame. I think England could frankly do with him tomorrow. I also think Hodgson was a bit naive to just assume that he would be available and would come, given his age and given his fitness, and crucially given that he plays for Manchester United and Sir Alex Ferguson is clearly in no mood to do the FA and England any favours at all. And then in terms of the Qatar trip, I don't think that's really relevant to his fitness. It's just a massive PR on goal for Rio. And whereas this time last week, there was a bit of sympathy for him withdrawing because of his treatment and his injury. And maybe it was sort of 70-30 against Rio. I think now it's sort of
99-1, as we saw on Friday night with England fans booing him. That wouldn't have happened if he'd have stayed in Manchester for treatment. But he's lost the fans by just being seen to be a kind of selfish, greedy footballer, even if he isn't.
Hughesy, I was obviously in Croatia when all this kicked off, but did the England fans know that he was on telly in Qatar when they were chanting?
Yes, they did.
That he was an onanist.
The story broke on Thursday morning, so it's been a pretty big story ever since. And I'm assuming that their hostile reaction was largely governed by his trip to Qatar rather than playing out in the first place.
But it certainly
exacerbated it.
The whole thing is an advert, as Gab says, for like footballers pay a lot of money to people to do their PR, to image rights, kind of, or image guides, and Sven Dali's looking after their commercial interests and whatever. Someone must have said to Ferdinand, Rio, if you go to Qatar and are on telly, having turned down the England chance to play for England, you will look like a bit of a knob. Just as someone must have, I mean, how has Hodgson allowed it to get to this stage? Did Hodgson not call Ferdinand and say, are you available to play? Why did Hodgson not establish this? The whole thing makes them all look like amateurs.
Yeah,
it does. I mean, Hodgson could have handled it better, and he's come across as being a bit old school and naive, assuming that these millionaires will just turn up to play for England whenever. And he's also underestimated the influence and power of club managers. Another example is Jack Wilshere. He's training for Arsenal today. Really, if in other circumstances, he could have been playing, but Wenger very cutely has seen a 10-day window and a 3-week period where there's only one Premier League game, so he's given him a rest, frankly, to sort of help his ankle recover. In other circumstances, he could have been playing. A stronger international manager working in a different country where the clubs aren't so powerful would have had Jack Wilshere playing for England tomorrow night. And I think it's sort of symptomatic of Hodgson's slight failure to grasp the importance and the sort of extent of his role, really, and the amount that personalities and politics have to play in the England manager's job. It's not like managing Finland or Switzerland. You don't just pick your best players and they turn up. You've got to be far cuter and more strategic in ensuring you get your best 11 on the pitch. And it's not just about football, it's about politics and lifestyle and the clubs and the showbiz. It's massive, and I think Roy's showing himself to be a bit out of his depth, to be honest.
Stuart, against Montenegro, it's potentially a big game. You slip up, and you could be talking playoffs, where, as you know, you could end up playing Spain.
Yeah, and also they've got two good players up front that I've seen a lot in Italian football. Jovetic is a very good player for Fiorentina, and Vucinic is playing really well for Juventus. Whether they can combine well and cause England centre-halves, because that's the big problem with the Rio Ferdinand situation. The centre-halves who are coming in aren't good enough. You know, I've seen Cahill this year, whether he's playing or not.
He's a champion of Europe.
He may be a champion of Europe, but he makes too many wrong decisions. I think he's got all the attributes, but he hasn't been coached at a young enough age to be a good player.
So can I just jump in there on the centre halves? I felt a few years ago, when you had Terry and Ferdinand and Ledley King, all these guys sort of in their pomp, and Carragher, I thought England are completely stacked with centre halves, you know, relative to... Now these guys, nobody seems to like them.
In terms of liking Terry or Ferdinand?
No. Or just liking Cahill, Lescott, Jags, all these people who are in
there. Because
why are these guys not as good as the guys 5-6 years before?
Coaching, for whatever reason, in this country, or at club level, at academy level, hasn't been as good.
Wait, sorry. So you're saying that Rio Ferdinand and Terry got better coaching growing up than Gary Cahill and Lescott?
Better understanding of defensive play. Because I see...
It's gotten worse in like 6-7 years.
Absolutely. The athleticism of players now is better. Sports science, and I think you might be getting onto that later on, sports science has taken over from coaching. Managers, and I won't name him, but there's a manager at a North London club that doesn't worry about the tactical side of the game. All he worries about is the sports science.
I'm assuming it's not Andre Villas-Boas you're talking about.
It's Edgar Davids at Barnet.
They're the
problem. He's going to come and get you.
Too many managers, and there's a difference between a manager and a coach. There's not enough coaching going on of defensive play, not enough tactical understanding of, about the game. And I see, I've seen England play, and I've been at the games, and I've seen some horrendous decisions that players have made at the back and got away with it. I see things happen in the Barclays Premier League week in, week out that I cannot believe are taking place. But it doesn't look as though the managers see it or the coaches see it, because it happens again the next week and the next week.
Well, there's something much simpler as well. I mean, Stuart is absolutely right, but there's something much simpler, which is that Gary Cahill, Julian Lescott and Phil Jagielka are not as good as John Terry. But like, that was a I'm going to use the term, I'm going to hate myself for it, a golden generation of central defenders. It was an unusually good crop of central defenders.
I agree with Rory here that, you know, these guys are, for all the bile and stuff that people have heaped on them, and some of it was no doubt for their own making, those guys were pretty darn good. Hughesy, I want to get you on this. Do you buy Stewart's coaching argument, and that's why they're the worst? And what about the people who are coming after them, your Calkers, your Smallings, people like that?
I think sometimes we're guilty of overthinking and overanalyzing the situation. The bottom line is Rio Ferdinand and John Terry, in different ways, were both exceptional centre-backs that come along, you know, once in a generation, once every two generations. Very few English centre-backs have had Rio's ball-playing ability. Very few have had John Terry's kind of determination, will to win. And also, he's a decent footballer. I mean, John Terry, for all the off-the-field stuff and the criticism, I think he's named in UEFA's Champions League Team of the Year like 4 years in a row or something. He's been a very good centre-back. And now, they're both getting on a bit in age, and for various other political reasons, they're unavailable. And we're discovering that the current crop, the second string, are not as good. That's no real surprise. When Wayne Rooney stops playing, we probably won't. And when Jack Wood stops playing, their replacements are unlikely to be as good. It's not a question no one likes these players. They're not doing it. Smalling and Lescott, the centre backs tomorrow, they're not first choice at their clubs, which is a problem, isn't it? Particularly in a key position like centre back.
Well, there's two very quick things. One is that after the feast, there always tends to be a famine. Hughes is perfectly right that when you get an incredibly good crop of players in a certain position, I guess, I don't know whether it's neglected by club managers or something, you know, that everything's fine, so there's, you don't bring the next generation through. But there is what I would agree with Stuart on is that there is a kind of structural difficulty with English defending, which is this idea of the John Terry style hero, which is what Cahill is trying to be, which is not good defending. Throwing your body on the line is not the mark of good defending. Not needing to throw your body on the line is the mark of good defending.
The best two centre-halves in recent times, not because he was technically great, but Carragher was the best reader of the game that England have had, and Carvalho, in my view, was a far better defender than John Terry. Carvalho kept John Terry as a top player for longer than he actually should have been.
Hughesy, I don't want to say as England fans, but you know, but I think we may not be England fans. I certainly want to see England do well. But what's the worst case scenario here? If they screw up against Montenegro, and all of a sudden you have to start thinking playoffs or maybe even worse. Well, what's the reaction going to be like?
Well, if England lose tomorrow, then the reaction will be very negative, and Hodgson's honeymoon period, if you like, very much comes to an end. I think England's position in this group is actually worse than many people realise. We're second, 2 points off the leaders, but we've only actually beaten San Marino twice and Moldova. If you look at the results, they've been very poor. We drew at home to Ukraine and drew away in Poland. On Friday night, Poland won 3-1 in Ukraine, which puts our result against Ukraine firmly into perspective. So this is often in the media we're guilty of overhyping games for our own self-interest, but this is a massive game for England tomorrow night, and if they don't get at least a draw, they're going to have real problems winning the group.
I love the fact that Hughesy started saying we. I don't know if you guys picked up on that at the start, referring to England. See, so deep down, I think he does have some love for the Three Lions.
It's your time, Gabriel.
His ringtone is actually World in Motion.
There you go. Let's move on to Scotland and Wales. Stuart, you touched upon Gordon Strachan before. This is his debut. there's a whole bunch of major structural deficiencies, I think, with Scotland right now. I was a bit surprised because, as we all know, the Scotland job doesn't pay a lot of money, not since the Bertie Vokes days. I'm assuming Strachan kind of took this job not out of money, but because he wants to make a difference or he believes he can make a difference. What can he do?
All he's got to do is try and organise them better. A national manager can't motivate players because they should be motivated enough. You don't get that much time with the players. So he's got to be tactically better. He's got to pick the right team.
Those are really the only two things somebody can do. All this crap people are like, oh, no, he's got to coach the coaches, inspire the next generation of players.
No, that should be somebody else's job.
And you're not going to do that in the first 6 months anyway.
We go back to Spain. Spain, when they weren't doing particularly well, when Germany weren't doing particularly well, their FAs got people together and said, right, we're not doing well enough. This is our vision and our philosophy for the next 20 years. And at Scotland at the moment, they can't do that because they're not developing players. The players they are developing aren't good enough to compete on an international level. And that's the problem that Gordon Strachan's going to have. And it's not his job now to go and coach the coaches. They've got to get a good technical director to oversee the coaching, oversee the vision and the philosophy. Then they employ a coach like Gordon Strachan to carry that out at the first team level. But what goes on beneath it for the next 20 years has to be done by somebody else.
It's quite interesting actually juxtaposing Scotland with Montenegro. So Scotland's got a population of like 5 million. And Scotland is a subject close to my heart, just for all my accent. Scotland is my team at international level. Montenegro, Dab has just made a rude sign at me. Montenegro's got a population of 625,000, right? It's not the case that Vucinic and Jovetic is some sort of freakish generation of great players that they've got. Montenegro, as an area, has always produced good players. Dejan Savicevic was Montenegrin, Pejman Mijatovic was Montenegrin. There is no reason that just as you have a small population that you should not produce players. East London produces loads of players.
Well, the Republic of Merseyside produces even better players.
Like Greater Manchester produces a lot of footballers.
Actually, not compared to Merseyside.
Well, I don't want to get into that debate now, Gab. There is no, but Scotland appears to have kind of acquiesced to fate and said, oh, we're too small to compete. It's complete nonsense. That country has all the ingredients to produce a lot of footballers. It's got a football culture. It's steeped in it, in fact. And it's got a lead where there's a lot of teams who could be playing young players. But for some reason, I don't know what it is, they don't seem to be able to sort of... Gab is laughing at me.
No, I'm absolutely shocked you didn't bring up Uruguay as an example, as half the population of Scotland. And well, I know it's close to your heart as well.
But Slovenia. Slovenia made two major tournaments. 2 million people in Slovenia.
That's marginally less than Uruguay, and they have better players than your Slovenian gods.
Scotland, although they didn't very badly, Uruguay. Scotland has no excuse for performing the way it is. It should be performing a lot better.
Bad Scotland, so saith Rory Smith. Out of love, of course. Hughesy, given that you have a Welsh last name, I'm going to just ask you about Wales. On paper, this is a remarkably good generation of players. I can't use the term golden generation because otherwise people get uncomfortable. But is it unfathomable that we might see them at a major tournament in the very near future?
Not unfathomable, but I think it's unlikely. I mean, they're going to have to, given their...
Well, they have better players in Scotland, right?
Yeah, they have, but it's stacked against them, given their poor coefficient, isn't it? So they're always going to be drawn in difficult groups.
Well, I want to take a brief detour here, because Rory, of course, you were in Croatia for this Croatia-Serbia game, and you were no doubt there because our boss is Tony Evans, and he loves a good ruck, and he figured that, if I send Rory there, he can chronicle all the violence. None of that happened. This is a situation where no news is good news. Can you tell us a little bit about what you were expecting and what you actually saw?
Yeah, well, so basically, obviously, Croatia-Serbia is fairly toxic as a derby. It's the second time they've played each other since the war ended in 1995. It's only the first time that they played as Croatia and Serbia, to the last time it was Yugoslavia, which was Serbia and Montenegro. The police banned all away fans from travelling, which is a relatively sensible decision, I would have.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times.
underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
So, if I can jump in there 1 second, in Italy we experience personally how much fun it is to have the Serbian away fans visit when they're up for it, because of course Italy played Serbia in the qualifiers to the European Championships, and you basically had like 400 people coming in and just absolutely destroying their stadium, hiding in like the belly of a bus. They had all these tattoos harking back to 1544, whatever it was. They're absolute nutters. Basically.
There was that big guy, that big bald guy, wasn't there, who stood on top of the
exactly,
the terrace in,
exactly.
In the Ferraris.
Who incidentally, his mum is quite well known interior decorator.
Oh, good. Oh, good. Yeah. So he's got a nice house.
He's a nice middle-class boy. So basically those dudes weren't there.
Well,
that's why there was no violence.
Well, we don't know if they weren't there, because speaking to Serbian journalists, there was a theory that some of them may have tried to make the trip, defying the police kind of ban.
And having some kind of death wish, I mean.
They would reveal themselves if Serbia scored. Now, I don't know if they were there and they just kept quiet because...
Good job they didn't score then.
I think it was the right result. It was a very straightforward 2-0 win. The Serbs were dreadful. Croatia was sort of okay, but not great. And by the end of the game, actually, it was quite interesting, the atmosphere had completely died, because the Croats had won after 40 minutes. The game was clearly over. There was no kind of triumphalism, and it passed off very peacefully. In Zagreb during the day, there were groups of fans on Banner Jelacica, which is the main square in Zagreb, which I've just mispronounced, and there were some songs celebrating the Ustasi, which is obviously the Croatian fascist group during the Second World War. There were mentions of Ante Dotovina. There was chants of kill the Serbs, which was all very unpleasant, but it was minority groups. It was little patches of quite young kids, generally, which obviously tend to make the trouble. And according to locals, I think it's only fair that I bow to their wisdom, it passed off a lot better than the atmosphere when Yugoslavia, Serbia and Montenegro played Croatia in 1999.
Which is also, of course, much closer to the actual war.
Yeah, absolutely. So it does sort of suggest that maybe things are changing slowly, gradually, that things are getting slightly better. I don't know if we'll be in a stage where Serbs can travel to Croatia for football matches anytime soon, but in the Balkans they're still talking, not at official levels, of a Balkan lead, of reinstituting the Yugoslav lead, which they do at handball and in basketball, and that they think they should do in football as well. And I think that might be necessary to get things back to normal, almost.
I mean, I find this to be a really cool story that they can go to that, because ultimately, I mean, I had the opportunity to spend a little bit of time with Siniša Mihajlović in the past, and you talk about somebody who's kind of like the poster boy of he's a Serb, but he's half Croatian. He calls himself part Gypsy. I don't know what the etymology there is. Montenegro, I guess, maybe, I don't know. And you kind of realize that all these people have friends and close ties on the other side, or indeed other sides. In this case, did you get any sense that this might happen in the next 5-10 years?
I spent a lot of time with two journalists who you probably know, Sasha Halida and Sasha Ibrulia, who want the second is Bosnian, the first is Croat. We spent a lot of time in Vukovar City Library, oddly enough. And what's really interesting is that, there are loads of mixed marriages throughout Bosnia, Serbia and Croatia. There's loads of people who are part Bosnian, part Croat, part Serbian, part Croat, whatever.
And very beautiful women in that part of Europe. Some might say probably the most beautiful women in all of Europe, with the exception of Iceland.
I would not No, I'd say more than Iceland, but I wouldn't comment on that because my missus would kill me. Anyway,
and she listens to the podcast.
She does not listen to the podcast. She does not know what the podcast is.
Just
anyway,
because you're on a diet doesn't mean you can't look at the menu.
Exactly, yes. Anyway, you've completely distracted me now, Gab. It's a really weird image.
You're telling me about the Sashas.
Yeah, no.
And how handsome they were.
So we spent a lot of time in Vukovar speaking to people who said that before 1991, ethnicity wasn't an issue. And I would take from that that there is the possibility that in the future, yeah, maybe it won't be an issue again, I guess. It will take a long time. But they do, yeah, they do play. They play each other in handball. They play each other in basketball. Obviously, if you start a Balkan league in football, there will be trouble. There will be fighting. There's no question about that. But maybe you need to kind of get through that to get to a stage where there isn't any fighting. Maybe you need to have the difficult period to get back to normality. I don't know. It's something that is on the agenda, and I personally think it would help Red Star Belgrade and Partizan and Dinamo Zagreb and all those clubs to play each other, because it would raise the standard of the league. There was a time when Yugoslav football was quite good. And just on another issue, Mihailovic, obviously a hugely controversial figure in Croatia, the nicest thing that happened on the day of the game was Croatia's Minister for War Veterans, of whom there are many, many thousands, who himself was interned in a Serb concentration camp, took a picture with Mihailovic, arms round him, embracing him, which was then tweeted by the son of someone who died in a Serb concentration camp, which was taken by people in Croatia as a really powerful moment to say, look, we have a future together. Mihailovic and Igor Stimac, the Croatian manager, embraced at the final whistle. There are efforts being made, I think, to...
It's insane when you think about it. I mean, Mihailovic and Stimac probably grew up playing football together.
They played against each other when they were 18, 19, but they've always hated each other, Mihailovic and Stimac, going back to the 1991 Yugoslav Cup final, as you know, Dan.
That, of course, that was the Boban Cup
final. No, different one. Different game.
There you go. You had all of them. In our debate this week, I'm going to try to be impartial and play devil's advocate, even though I've got quite strong views on this subject. Surprise, surprise. Right now, there's a trial going on in Spain. It's a trial of a doctor named Eufemiano Fuentes, who... how can I put this nicely? It's alleged and pretty much proven that he helped a whole number of professional cyclists dope and was sort of a master of performance-enhancing drugs. Now, the interesting thing with Fuentes is that several of the cyclists he worked with have alleged that Fuentes told them that he also worked with football clubs. And to be careful here, because there have been lawsuits. The French newspaper Le Monde alleged that he worked with Barcelona and Real Madrid specifically. They sued Le Monde, and Le Monde withdrew that allegation. But it does appear that certainly Fuentes told people that he worked with football clubs. He hasn't actually admitted to it. I want to broaden this out to the issue of performance-enhancing drugs. And the most recent news last week is that Fuentes came out and said, oh, yes, Real Madrid actually owe me money. People said, oh, they owe him money because he helped them dope. And Real Madrid then specified, no, that they do owe him money, but it's because he testified for them in the trial with Le Mans, in the libel trial. And then he's like, oh, yeah, actually, that's why they owe me money. So as this goes on, I think it's fair to wonder, though, we've had issues with performance-enhancing drugs and drug cheats in the past in football. Most recent cases, I think, were in the late 90s, and so the turn of the millennium. We haven't heard so much of it then. Roy, I want to start with you. What's your general sense on this? Is this – do we not have them anymore because we've got better at testing, because people realize that this kind of stuff isn't worth it, or have we not had them because they're so good at covering it up?
Looking at the experience of other sports, you'd probably have to say that sort of option C on that one. I think in terms of they're not worth it, that I remember speaking to Michel Duger, the FIFA chief medical officer, who told me that football is not immune to PEDs, but is kind of safer than, say, cycling, because it's not a pure endurance sport. You have to have technique and ability. That is completely missing the point of the debate, because obviously it's much better to have your full technique and ability for 90 minutes than 60. And if you need to take EPO or CERA or whatever to achieve that, then you will. So I suspect that the idea that football is immune to it is nonsense. You would assume that the test. I mean, in terms of the testing, I think I worked out that the UK Sport, who do the testing in England, do 5,000 tests on footballers a year, which is far more than most sort of governing bodies in most countries do on footballers. But they
less
do that
than Italy.
Possibly less than Italy,
less.
But it's, I think it's more
about,
I think,
a quarter, in fact.
I think it's a decent, it's considered a decent number. But they do that across the professional and amateur game, and if you think about how many footballers there are, that means that if you're a professional footballer, there's kind of a chance you might be tested once a year.
Right.
Which
you,
I would suggest is not enough.
I would suggest though that they do get tested far more regularly if they play in UEFA competitions and
yeah.
internationally.
Yeah.
Because people are drawn after games and things
and
like that.
And have to do the urine test, but it's not blood testing, which is, urine testing is far less effective. So I think there's an issue there in terms of, yeah, and in terms of the way, the general story of doping, in every sport, the dopers are ahead of the... ahead of the authorities. That's happened. That's the, I mean, we're talking about stuff that happened in cycling 7 or 8 years ago. So God knows what those who are doping in cycling are doing now. They're not taking first generation EPO, but they're probably taking something else that we can't test for. And that's the problem. That problem, it would be insanely arrogant to assume that that problem does not exist in football.
Stuart, you played back in the 1960s when there was no. Stuart. I take on board what Rory says. By the same token, one thing which doesn't fully add up to me is that where people have been caught doping in the past, there were always rumors. There was always background noise about this. And this is because football clubs are bigger communities, right? And they're sort of transient communities. Players come and go. You've got agents around the players. They compete with their clubs and they compete with their national teams, which means a whole different set of doctors and a whole different set of testers and things like that. And when people were caught in the past, I'm thinking of some Russian clubs. I'm thinking of Juventus in the late 90s, where they weren't actually they didn't actually fail a blood test, but obviously there was a big trial which showed that they were using legal drugs improperly. The Dutch guys who were all sort of busted for nandrolone all around the same time. There was always rumors. There was always background noise. There was always chatter. I mean, we all – I mean, you're a footballer and a coach. Roy and I, we talk to people in the game all the time. Correct me if I'm wrong, Rory. I haven't heard allegations about anybody at the top level for maybe 10 years now.
Not until the Fuentes thing started, no.
Yeah, and then the Fuentes thing is, you know, it's all stuff that happened before. And so that's the kind of thing which makes me – it's not contemporary allegation, basically. That's the kind of thing which makes me think, all right, has football become so good at keeping secrets? Are footballers that good at keeping in the football community? Or is it maybe that – it's actually not happening.
Well, I was involved in management and coaching up until 5.5 years ago, and I never came across any sort of drugs, players being rumoured to be on drugs. The only problem we ever had as a couple of the football clubs was recreational drugs. There was never, and we were also sponsored at one point at Wimbledon by a company that does a well-known company that does all the protein shakes and all that sort of stuff. And our sports scientist at the time fitness coach John Goodman said that.
By the way, not the Hollywood actor, just the guy with the same name.
That the players weren't allowed to take it just in case to protect ourselves. They weren't allowed to take it because this company had been responsible for four athletes being proven to take performance enhancing drugs. So we, although we used the bottles and although it was our own drinks that went into them, because we were frightened that the players could sue us if we were the company that was sponsoring our football club,
right,
had put the wrong thing in their drinks. So we were never involved in, we would never suggest that they should be taking these protein shakes and all this sort of stuff because we were worried what was in them.
See, I think this is a really interesting area with drugs in general. Because I think that protein shake thing is really interesting. Because one of Arsene Wenger, one of his great sort of developments when he first came to England was creatine, that he gave players creatine, which is legal, perfectly legal, not in any way suggesting Arsene Wenger is a drug pusher. There's enough people in this room who don't like Arsene Wenger as it is. As a player, did you encounter any
no.
not illegal substances, but sort of were you given supplementary kind of
if
pills?
You look at, I played in the from 81 to 93, and if you look at the shape of players' bodies in those times to the shape of players' bodies now, there's certainly been a massive improvement in diet, in protein shakes, whatever it is, because players are totally, they're leaner, they look fitter, their body shape is totally different to how players were. If you see a footballer in the 80s with his shirt off, there's not too much definition. They're not fat, but there's not too much definition. So something's changed in the diet, and all the players do take supplementary protein shakes, but they're not prescribed by the in my experience by the doctors at the football clubs.
But that raises two issues. One is why this is nothing new. So I will use the term Café Herrera, which Gab will understand.
Yeah,
which was the potion that Elenio Herrera gave his players at Inter.
Amphetamines.
In the 90s.
Basically.
It was speed in people's coffee, it was.
But, I mean, let's be clear on this. I mean, there are certain drugs you can take where you get instant results. And obviously, 1960s, before widespread testing, if I give you amphetamines, you will play better because more blood will flow to your brain, or even ephedrine, right? The problem is you will then crash. Well, beyond the fact that it can cause an irregular heartbeat and all the stuff, and you could die. But in the best case scenario, you can crash, right? Which means all of a sudden you've got no energy left whatsoever, right? So, but the thing is, that is very easy to test for. I don't think anybody has taken that for the past 20 plus years.
But what I'm saying is that this is not a new phenomenon. The idea that there might be drugs in football goes back decades.
I think what players were most worried about, and there were players that were where I was working, they were most worried about when the drug testers came in on a Monday morning, was that they would be caught for recreational drugs. That was their big fear. Not any enhancing drug for their physical attributes. It was all about recreational drugs, and that's the biggest problem in football.
That was in the 1980s when the Bolivian marching powder was king, right?
I'm talking more recently, 5-6 years ago. It was still a real problem at the football club that I was working at.
It would not surprise anyone, I think, if to discover that cocaine was particularly a problem for footballers.
One player, and the doctors didn't relate this to us. There was one player that had already been caught several years ago, and he had kept on saying having Mondays off. And we didn't know why. He said, you know, traffic was bad, this was bad, I can't get in for this, I've got flu. And we, after a while, it was realised that he was he was under pressure to because he knew that was when the drug testers came in.
Fabio Capello and Jose Mourinho will both be at Stamford Bridge Monday night as Brazil take on Russia. Rory, who has the greater chance of actually getting a job there?
Well, given that Mourinho is there purely in a watching capacity, I would suggest that this obviously is a more important night in terms of an audition for Fabio Capello, who's doing quite well with Russia, to be honest. But I would not have thought that Roman Abramovich would be looking at Capello long-term, really. Although, having said that, I suppose, given that apart from Mourinho, there's no real outstanding candidates, Capello, I guess, could be in with a shout, but then I can't see Roman wanting to take him off the hands of the Russian FA.
So your answer, simply put, is Mourinho. Reigning world and European champion Spain are away to France Tuesday night. Stuart, if they don't win, they could well be headed to the playoffs. Can you picture the unthinkable happening? And why are they struggling? Oh, and by the way, the last time they failed to win consecutive matches on home soil was at the 1982 World Cup, before Rory was even born.
Well, Spain had, I would say, 90% of possession against Finland.
82, actually, but you're close.
And Finland decided to put all their players in their defending third. But what Spain have to do, and it's the same with Barcelona, they do not want to lose a World Cup or lose a European title because they don't change their game slightly. I mean, they had so much possession, they'll keep the ball, they won't get players into the box. At some point, you have to cross the ball. That's why Barcelona lost to Inter a couple of years ago. If you have all that possession, you have to make teams defend. It's too obvious where the ball was going to come. If they played little diagonal balls, how did Spain score their goal? From a cross into the box, and Ramos actually scores. So they have to just vary their game every so often.
Sergio Ramos, 100 caps already. He's on pace to get more than 200. Incredible. One of my favorite players, even with all his flaws. Rory, I don't really follow the championship much, but I do know that a 20-year-old Czech striker named Matej Vidra was named Player of the Year in the championship. Phillips after some folks had derided him, some folks who shall remain nameless, had derided him upon his arrival as another Czech no-name. I understand you spent some time with the Watford folks. Are you surprised?
I'm not surprised that Vidra doing well in the Championship. When he was a kid, he was extraordinarily highly rated, and Udinese, his parent club, were considered to have pulled off quite a coup in landing him. He's had injury problems, maybe not fulfilled, blossomed into the talent we thought he would be, although I understand that several quite large football clubs across Europe are monitoring his progress. In terms of whether am I surprised at Watford being a success, absolutely not. There is no more impressive man in football than Gino Pozzo.
I wonder where you got all that intel from. No more impressive man in football? In all of football?
You heard what I said?
Crikey. Michael Owen announced last week that he'll be retiring at the end of the season. Stuart, where do you rank him amongst the greatest ever English centre forwards? And was his demise just down to injury or something else?
When he started off, watching him play for Liverpool, watching him play for England, it was great pace that got him in behind people. He played with an enthusiasm. But in the long term, his technical quality wasn't quite good enough, and his tactical understanding and reading of the game. So when he lost his pace, he wasn't the same sort of player. And when he went to Real Madrid, he was found out technically. He couldn't play with the other players. So in terms of where do I rank him as an England striker, yes, he scored a lot of goals, so he's got to be somewhere up there. But it was all about his pace and not about his technical quality. So I wouldn't rate him that highly.
I'm going to throw out some names. You tell me if you take him ahead of Owen. Shearer.
Shearer better than Owen.
Rooney.
Better than Owen.
Lineker.
Better than Owen.
Greaves.
Better than Owen.
Fowler.
Not better than Owen.
Ooh, let's make sure Tony Evans doesn't hear that bit.
Gab, one for you. Jose Mourinho, the former Chelsea manager, claims he didn't go to the FIFA Ballon d'Or ceremony because of irregularities in the voting. It seems he was proved right. How big a scandal is this?
Well, to me, it's not really a scandal, because I remember 3 years ago I went and I thought I had a great story, because no fewer than 7 Ballon d'Or voters came out and said, hang on a minute, I voted for Xavi, but my vote got counted for Xabi Alonso. And funny enough, nobody was interested in the media here. So I ended up writing it in the Excellent Times game blog. The reality is FIFA have major problems at running elections. Again, back in 2010, a whole bunch of nations seemingly couldn't get their ballots back, and their ballots weren't counted. And you know, you might think, oh well, it's the kind of nations where you know, they don't have telephones and fax machines. No, it's Norway, it's Argentina, it's Chile, it's Qatar, it's the Republic of Ireland. it's countries like that. So the realities are just rubbish at this. In this case, it seems pretty obvious that, you know, Pandev's come out. I've been in touch with his agent as well. He's like, no, I wanted to vote for Mourinho. I told the Macedonian FA my top three are this, and they just kind of filled out the ballot any which way they wanted to. Now, that said, Vicente del Bosque got 68% of the vote. Mourinho got 20.5%. I don't think it would have made a major difference. I think you have to take these things for what they are. But one other thing, though, in this is he says he didn't go because he knew of the irregularities ahead of time. Now, unless he's clairvoyant, that's impossible, because FIFA didn't actually publish the votes until the night of the ceremony itself. Most likely, he didn't go because he wanted to make some kind of statement. That's all we've got time for this week. It's been fun, and it's been real, and it's been real fun. Thanks to my guests, Stuart Robson, Rory K. Smith, and of course, and especially most of all, Matt Hughes. Come find us on Twitter to share your thoughts, or you can email us, as so many of you do every single week, gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk. You'll find all our news, our views, our web chats, our blogs, and analysis. Rory, do you have a blog this week?
Not this week, next week.
I got a blog next week. Next week will be a blog spectacular week from myself and Rory K. Smith. And of course, we always love to hear from you on Twitter, especially Rory. You can share stories of attending posh private schools with him. Till next week, bye-bye.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.